Right, good evening, everybody. Okay, I trained as an engineer, which apparently makes me annoying, because scientists like to focus on little tiny bits of the problem. I like to look at the whole system, because often, if you look at one part, you really ignore some of the critical precursor stages, which often, if you really want to solve the problem, go back to the beginning. That's always the way to do it. I'm sort of known at the moment for this. People call it the Hideous Green Book. You wouldn't miss it, but it's two-colour printing, half the energy of four-colour printing, but people seem, they seem to want me to have a nice graphical cover, but no. I'm actually on tour at the moment. I've nearly finished. I've spoken around about 1,300 people now, so tonight's audience will take it up a bit. So what's happening at the moment? Oil prices are going up, gas prices are going up. Why is that? It's all to do with the availability of energy globally. And if you go back to the 1960s, there were people like Paul Ehrlich. You go to the 1970s, the Club of Rome, the Limits to Growth. They all say we're going to run out of things. This country uses an awful lot of energy. And at the moment, most of that is carbon-based. Now, globally, you would think, well, what energy do we use? The world uses about 480 exajoules of energy. An exajoule is a one followed by 18 noughts joules. And if you take a Bramley apple and lift it up 1 meter, you've given it a joule of energy. At the moment, 88% of that energy is fossil fuel based. Why do we have climate change? It's because 88% of all the energy in the world is either coal, gas, or oil. About 36% is oil, about 24% is gas, and about 28% is coal. 6% is nuclear. So all that fuss about nuclear, it's actually very little. And if we stopped growing for a few years and invested the, you know, the money into saving energy, we could actually turn off nuclear relatively quickly. We actually get more energy. Another 6% comes from the big hydro dams all around the world. Slightly more energy comes from hydro dams than comes from all the nuclear power stations around the globe. So we have a system that's dominated by fossil fuels. If we go to the UK level, and this is where it gets difficult because I really do need to show you a graph for this one. Britain uses about 10.4 exajoules of energy per year. So 1% of the world's population in this country, we're using about 2.4% of the world's energy. So we're consuming a bit above our weight, if you like. In 1970, most of that energy was oil and coal. And over the last 35 years, there's been a slow transition. Coal has shrunk because over the years, we've used less and less coal. Oil, 70 years ago, was a very important part of our economy. And nearly all of that oil was imported. But over the last 35 years, gradually, industry has stopped using oil. At the same time, we have more cars and we're driving them further. And those two effects have balanced each other out. So in 35 years, we've actually used very little difference in the amount of oil that we're using. Gas is really interesting. In 1970, most of the gas in this country was made from coal. So areas like Nottinghamshire, the coal was dug up, turned into gas. And so our use of gas, very closely, there's that graph of the globally traded energy. You can see it's 88% fossil fuel. And this is the UK. That's 1970. That's 2005. There's the coal slowly disappearing. That was the miners' strike. I'm in Nottinghamshire. I better not talk about it. See, oil has remained roughly constant. Now, gas slowly grew. If I put gas into your home, you heat your home at about 75% efficiency. If I put the gas into a power station, make electricity, put the electricity into your home and you heat your home electrically, it's about 46% efficient. So there used to be a prohibition on generating electricity with gas because it was wasteful. That was got rid of in 1986. 5-year build time for a gas-fired power station. All that expansion is electricity from gas. Nuclear reached a peak in about 1998, and unless we build any more, then the nuclear will disappear about 2020, 2025. But although we might talk about building a new range of nuclear power stations in this country, in 1999, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development pointed out that if we did try to go nuclear to solve climate change, the uranium would run out in 12 years. Because actually, there's not a lot of uranium in the world. Renewables, they come in at the top. At the moment, about 3% of Britain's energy comes from renewable. Unfortunately, what you might consider to be renewable, the government has a bit of a different idea. The majority of our renewable energy in this country is either burning or burying rubbish. Only 4% is wind, only 10% is hydro, 0.6% is solar. Most of it is getting rid of rubbish, and that's because our renewable energy policy came from a time when we focused on waste management as a source of energy, not actually to displace conventional fossil fuel generation. So this is a scale drawing of the UK's energy supply in 2005, and everything is to scale, so the thickness of the lines in any direction are proportional to each other. Same colour coding, the red is oil, the black is coal, the blue is gas. I'd like to spend a bit of time, but we haven't got it, but to quickly sum up, if we're talking about problems in the future of oil supply, pretty much all the oil in this country goes straight into the transport sector. So oil, it hits driving. We can get around that problem. There are ways of using a lot less energy. You know, if we strictly enforced a 60-mile-an-hour speed limit in this country, we'd take, I think it's 5% off of fuel consumption. We'd actually save 2 million tonnes of carbon per year doing that. Gas is the big one because, on average, each home consumes 70% of its energy from natural gas. So if we have a problem in the future with gas supply, we get it in our homes, and that's the real difficulty. In the 1980s, we were worried that the Russians were going to press the button and fry us all. And now we're worried they're going to press the button and freeze us all. So, again, from the 80s, we have this word that's coming back into the mainstream usage, which is geopolitics. After the Berlin Wall came down, we thought we were going to live in a different world, but the old world is returning. Today, it's not which political system rules the world, but who has the energy and who's willing to trade the energy with who on what terms. The other thing I should point out, this is electricity, the yellow. We might use the coal or gas or nuclear to make the electricity. On average, our power stations are 36% efficient. Put 100 units of energy in, only 36 come out as electricity. The rest, as you will know from living near power stations in the Nottingham area, is just thrown away. Only a fifth of the energy we consume in this country as end users is electricity. But if you look in the media, you would think that everything was electricity. It's not. And this is the problem. In the media debate, we concentrate on about one-fifth of the problem and ignore the four-fifths. And actually, that other four-fifths is very important. It's transport fuels, and it's mostly heat. And in a temperate climate in the winter, it's heat that is actually potentially more important than electricity. You can get by with a candle. If you're cold, you can't. The other problem with the energy debate, you would think it was all about your home, that your home is the big environmental offender. Homes are only about 30% of energy supply. And in fact, they're only about 25% of carbon emissions. And again, if we concentrate on one sector in the energy economy to the exclusion of all others, the solutions we produce won't be effective because all these other areas will still be consuming, still be pumping the carbon. If you're interested, all these slides are online on the website, and that's all my handouts over there. So if you take the web address, you can download these and look at your leisure. So the government, I should point out, this isn't my data. By and large, I use everybody else's data, but perhaps in ways they hadn't anticipated. This is the government's Joint Energy Security Supplies Committee data. The government set up this committee in 2001 with the objective to keep the lights on. Since Edward Heath, governments have a phobia of people shivering in the dark. So, you know, they really would do anything now to make sure we never run out of gas. This is Britain's indigenous production. This is real data until 2005. So in 2005, we produced four-fifths of the energy we consume in this country. Again, same colour coding, black is coal, red oil, blue gas. And we imported one-fifth. The light grey is imported coal. We import about two-thirds of our coal. The light blue is gas, and the purple is the uranium that goes into nuclear. The government's own forecasters say that by 2020 we'll be importing 4/5 and producing 1/5. There's only one other country in the world that does that at the moment, and that's Japan. And they can do that because they have a thing called a manufacturing economy. They make things, they sell them abroad, the money comes in, and then they can send the money out again to pay the energy bill. We can't do that. We don't make things anymore. And so some economists really doubt whether or not we could pay the bill for this. And in fact, we're going back to the 70s. In the 70s, we had problems with the pound, we had problems with foreign exchange, purely because we had more money going out than was coming in. We took out big loans and we couldn't pay them. And because of this idea that we can just import energy to keep growing, that's where we're heading back to. Let's divert and look at carbon and climate change. I have what's considered a controversial view. There is no problem called climate change. There is a symptom called climate change. In this country, 90% of all our carbon emissions are the direct result of energy use. So if you sort out energy use, you will automatically sort out the carbon. And for me, this is the underlying issue. Don't try and stop the problem at the end of the pipe, because that's the most inefficient way of doing it. If you really want to stop the carbon, go to the beginning of the system and look at the sources. This is global carbon emissions as carbon. The data actually goes for 250 years. We have really good data going back to about 1950. Before that, it's assumed what the carbon emissions were because we knew how much coal was dug. We knew how much steel was produced because in those days, people paid tax on it. They sold it. So we have pretty good data as to what the carbon emissions were around the world. 250 years, 305,000 billion tons of carbon. It takes 30 years for carbon to affect the climate. If you look at the banner over by the door, it shows you the carbon level in the atmosphere going up over the years. And at the moment, we have 383 parts per billion of carbon in the atmosphere. That's the highest it's been for about 3 million years. That's at ground level, and we emit it at ground level. But to have an effect on climate, it has to go 2 to 8 miles up and then all around the planet to produce the thermal blanket that causes the warming. So there's at least a 30-year delay. So if we knock off 30 years on this data, before 1973, we emitted 130,000 billion tons. Between 1973 and 2003, which is the end of this data, we emitted 176,000 billion tons. We're going to get climate change because we have 30 years worth in the post, which we can do nothing about. And if you go to Hadley Centre briefings, if you go to university briefings, what the scientists are banging the tables about now, we're not about stopping climate change. We're about stopping dangerous climate change. And that, unfortunately, hasn't really made it through the media. You get odd references, but really, we're talking about the survival of the species now. We're not talking about a little bit of sea level rise. There's a couple of ideas at the moment. The red line is Kyoto. The green line is contraction and convergence. If you're working on the climate bill, it's contraction and convergence. You can't call it that, but that's what it is. Kyoto, if you look at the process that's envisaged, it's another 361,000 billion tonnes, more than we've already emitted. You know, this is all about the area under the graph, and it's a very slow process of transition before we start adding together all the small savings to make big savings. Contraction and convergence, which is a bit more radical, that seeks to go out, find where you can save carbon and do it. So it's more of a straight line. That's another 221,000. Personally, I'd like to do the opposite of that and cut as much as possible, as quickly as possible. And there's an interesting parallel here, that if we're talking about problems of energy supply, we're talking about getting recessions. And you notice that this line isn't straight. It has all these little kinks and teeth on it. And every one of those is an economic recession. From 1929 until 1932-33, we shaved a quarter off the world's carbon emissions in 4 years because of a recession. In 1981-84, it wasn't so good. It was only about 9% in four years. If you think climate change is the worst problem for humanity, it's about our survival. A 50-year, never-ending recession, that will solve the problem. It's just unpalatable. And this is why we need something between business as usual and out-and-out recession. Because if we do nothing about the energy problem, we are going to get that. And this is why. There's a world-renowned geologist called Marion King Hubbert. He was into geophysics, did lots of work on plate tectonics before World War II. After the Second World War, he wanted a nice retirement job. He went to work for Shell in America. And from 1947, he went through huge numbers of production records for oil wells all across the lower 48 states of America. That's all of continental America, but not including Alaska. And he found this trend in every one. If you put an oil well in the ground, you get a gusher or comes out, and production will go up. These have got flat tops because the pipe only has a certain size. And so you put more oil wells in the ground to get more oil out. And what he found was halfway through the total production of a particular field, production would peak and would then fall again. Now, since this time, we've started to do things like pump water underneath the oil, because oil is lighter than water, to force the oil out. More recently, we've started pumping carbon dioxide under the oil, because carbon dioxide flushes even more oil out. But it doesn't arrest the decline. You still end up with this trend. And in fact, the data from the North Sea, which was using many of these techniques from the early 80s, you know, if we do all these what's called advanced recovery, the collapse is actually slightly faster. So he did that work. He published his first paper in 49. In 1956, which is just here, he made a prediction at a conference. American oil production will peak in 1970 and then fall. And this dark line is his prediction. And he destroyed his career. He was laughed out the room. And in 1970, the American Petroleum Institute was publishing an article saying, hey, look, we've never produced as much oil as we did this year. In 1973, they said, oh dear. And it was coincidental that 73, the year they discovered that American oil production was falling, we had the Saudi oil crisis when they turned the taps off. The light grey line is the actual production data until, on this, it's 2001, and that's the projection. So he wasn't spot on, but the trend is absolutely correct. The difference between these two lines, they found a bit more oil. There was a little bit he didn't know about, but the actual peak date, he was spot on. This is our own North Sea. We don't have peak oil theory in Britain. We've done it already. We have peaked. This is 1970. That's 2005. The red line is our consumption. The dark red line is North Sea production. So from the mid-70s until about 85, production went up. Then we had the Piper Alpha disaster, and it shut down again. Early 80s, it went up. Now, what I call the happy-clappy geology, they were looking at the peak in the North Sea. In this country, sometime in 2006-07, the International Energy Agency, one quote I've seen from them, was talking about 2011. 1999, it peaks and begins to fall. And it is falling, and it has not stopped falling, even though we've brought on another oil field in the meantime. One of the reasons I'm doing the UK tour, this year Britain will become a net oil and gas importer. And from now on, it's all economically downhill, really. This is natural gas. All resources you dig out the ground peak. That's the evidence. And again, over here, gas was made from coal. In the 80s, we consumed more gas than we produced because we imported some. Then in the 90s, we became a gas exporter. And again, the idea of peak gas, it was accepted, but the idea was it would peak sometime in 2007 or 2008. And if you look at the import terminals that are being built today, their completion dates are 2007 and 2008, because that's when they thought they would peak. Guess what? We peaked in 2003, and last year became a net importer of gas. So whether we like it or not, there is absolutely nothing we can do about this. We either address the energy problem in this country, or this country has problems. If we look globally, this is the projection. Using Hubbert's method, people have gone away and said, OK, what will happen internationally? The light data is real. The grey data is projection. This is America peaking in 1970, as I just showed you. There's the North Sea peaking in 2000. The Norwegians peaked a couple of years after we did, so the average is about 2000. Russia's oil production fell after the end of communism, and they haven't done a lot since. And taking back the oil industry into government control isn't helping. This is the rest of the world, and this is the Middle East. For 30 years, the Middle East has been what's called a swing producer. If we needed more oil, they turned the taps on. If the price got too low, they turned the taps off. That's why the bottom of this line is flatter than the top. And notice again, the dip in oil consumption here, that's the early 70s recession, early 80s recession, early and late 90s recessions. We save energy in recessions. If you put it all together, we're going to get an oil peak. On this graph, this is an old graph, the new one, it's about 2010, 2011. However, there's been a development. There's a man called Stuart Staniford who, he crunches data. He seems to be a statistician. This is oil production in Saudi Arabia. The top line is two different sources of data for how much they're producing. This blue line is how many active oil rigs they have drilling holes in Saudi Arabia. And at the beginning of 2005, the number went up and up all the way into the beginning of 2007. And even though they were drilling more holes, no extra oil was coming to the surface. And for quite a few people, that was the wake-up call. And this is the stuff I got sent last Friday. A bit complicated because I haven't had... He's not really a communicator. I like more simple graphs than this. But, this is seven different sources of production data for Saudi Arabia from the first quarter of 2006 to the first quarter of this year, and it's down. Saudi Arabia, according to this, has peaked. This is all the seven official sources of data. This wiggle here, that was the opening of the Harad free field, I think it's called, an extra 300,000 barrels of oil per day. It didn't arrest the decline. It's still going down. If Saudi Arabia has peaked, the world has peaked. It's going to take probably 18 months for the world to wake up to that fact. And there's a wonderful man on Wall Street called Stephen Leeb. He's made all his money about speculating on science and resource issues which nobody else took any attention of. He says that when the world does wake up to this, we won't be paying a pound a litre for petrol, perhaps £6 or £7 a litre. So this is going to happen whether we like it or not. Now there is, there are a number of alternatives, but for me, it's all about contraction. If you're using too much energy, trying to get more energy is like giving an addict more drugs. It doesn't solve the problem, it just perpetuates it. We need to contract. And interestingly, if we contract energy, it also solves the carbon problem. And it isn't just the UK that has to do this, the world has to do this now. Because if we have reached the oil peak, the projection at the moment is that 2010, 2015, we may see the earliest date for the gas peak. There's a report come out from some researchers in Germany who are attached to the European Commission. They're looking at a global coal peak from sometime between 2030 to 2050. You know, all the dense energy sources are running out because we've used them. And so we have to think of a new economic paradigm to match that idea. And it's called less. We don't need to produce more energy, we need to produce less. Petrol will become expensive in 10 years. I mean, very expensive. Because at the moment, Saudi is just falling off. But that decline will accelerate as the years go on. And then there will be a severe global shortage of oil. Gas will become more expensive because the cost of oil and gas are related. They come from the same infrastructure often. Just as a time we're switching to more natural gas. You know, we are a country who are hooked on natural gas. And we have to solve that addiction because we just won't be able to continue that. Even if we build all these import terminals, they're building them now in Milford Haven. There's one at the Isle of Grain in the Thames Estuary. There are plans for two or three others. Even if we build them, there may be no gas to put into them in 15 or 20 years' time. Coal creates a problem with climate change. We could sequester the carbon. But that can take 15 to 25% of the energy of the power station to store. So you're throwing away, in effect, up to 25% of your resource to store the carbon. Isn't it far better just to stop using it in the first place? And nuclear too. The uranium won't last that long. Even if the whole world went nuclear, we have 60 years of uranium at the moment. If the whole world goes nuclear to solve this problem, even the OECD are looking at 10 to 20 years, and then it's gone. Renewable energy cannot fill the gap. I like to take about an hour and 20 minutes to do this usually, and I'll explain the detail behind this, but we cannot get our current energy supply from renewables because it would exceed the capacity of the environment to deliver it. so we just have to get by on less. Interestingly, if you look at what we have to do, it's about a 75% contraction. If you factor in the difference in the efficiency of use, what does 75% less from today look like? It looks about like 1950. It's not medieval, it's not Stone Age. The only real problem is cars. We can't have so many cars as we have today, so we're looking at about 2 million cars perhaps being able to be supported by biofuels. That's going back to about 1935. So we have to cut consumption by about 1 to 2% per year for the next 50 years. It's not rocket science. It's not difficult. It's just change. And if we can get our heads around this idea that we have to do it because it's the laws of physics, you can't negotiate with the laws of physics. They're really annoying. So I think it's doable. So before Brian starts, and this is the top level view, if you like. Brian will do a more Nottinghamshire sort of view. Hold this idea in your mind. Why not just have less? Because that is really the only option we can physically do within the limitations of the planet and live. Thank you.